Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
What's up, Open Floor Globe? This is Ben Golver with the Washington Post. I am joined on the other line by Michael the Pod Pina, who is writing everywhere, GQ, 538, and plenty of other places. Michael, I saw you had a big interview with Bill Walton this week, all sorts of other good stuff. People need to be following you on both Twitter and Instagram. Come on, step up, Open Floor Globe. It's at Michael V as in Victor Pina. Now look, I'm giving you such a friendly and nice plug, Michael, because today's a tough day. Usually when I call you in the morning, you're like, hey, buddy, how's it going? You've got all sorts of pep and charm on the other end. Today, it did sound a little bit like your family pet died, Michael. How are you holding up? Did Tyler Hero flush your goldfish down the toilet last night? I mean, walk me through the pain of game four with the Miami Heat taking a powerful, commanding 3-1 lead over the Boston Celtics in the Eastern Conference Finals.
Yeah, it was brutal. One of those games where, I mean, first of all, like, you know, I was pretty confident in the Celtics just being a more talented, more athletic, faster, better shooting team than the Miami Heat. So, like, I picked them in five before the series, and for it to possibly end the other way is, like, an outcome I didn't even see as possible. I don't think it's going to end in five as it is, but just a, like, it's like one of those games where it's just like sports happens and it's completely unpredictable. Even though I, heading into the series, when you watch basketball as a fan, you kind of view it a little differently, where like when a certain player has the ball in their hands on the other team that's facing your favorite team, you get really afraid or you get really happy depending on what you think of them. And so with Hero, even though he's a 20-year-old rookie, heading into the series, just after watching his rookie season and watching him perform against the Milwaukee Bucks, I was like, when Tyler Hero has the ball in his hands, I don't feel comfortable. Like, I feel physically ill. I want him to pass it immediately and just, like, relocate.
No, he's a chainsaw massacre waiting to happen. I feel you. I don't think you're the only fan base, by the way, who feels that way about him. But continue.
No, he's incredible. And, like, I think I saw or heard on one of Zach Lowe's recent podcasts, like, the Miami Heat believe that Tyler Hero can be better than Devin Booker someday. And there's so many similarities there physically, how they play. And that is really scary to think about. Just like the fact that this dude had 37 in game four of the Eastern Conference Finals against one of the best defenses in the league. And this
well,
is his first
go
around.
So is someday like next Monday or Tuesday? I mean he's got more big game experience already than Devin Booker in his first year. I'll say that. I kid slightly, Michael. This is going to seem like I'm really digging in, but I can understand how blindsided you sound and rightfully how blindsided you feel at this moment. I didn't see Game 4 playing out that way either. It was a game that was right there for the taking because both teams were struggling so much offensively. Miami was not hitting anything from outside. Boston got a big zero from number zero in the first half, and it was just a strange game. It seemed like perhaps they were playing with heavy hearts because of the Breonna Taylor ruling that came out. Both Jimmy Butler and Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown all talked about that in their post-game comments. Tyler Hero did too, and frankly, both coaches did before the game, so it was a major topical conversation. You don't know if that influenced exactly how this game shook out or if it was a matter of an extended break really for the first time during the postseason runs for these guys and trying to get back into it, or if just defense was better than offense. Regardless, the game was there for the taking, and the youngest guy on either roster, a player who was born in the year 2000, decided to take it. I mean, just for historical context, Tyler Hero's 37 points were the second most ever in an NBA playoff game by a player before his 21st birthday. The only guy to do it's a very obscure name for all of our listeners around the world. You might have heard of him, Magic Johnson, in the 1980 finals with the incredible 42 points before his 21st birthday. So very, very special company for Hero. And he did not do it on easy shots. I mean, so much of it was one-on-one. So much of it was actually Booker style, frankly. You know, creating stuff off the dribble, doing it in late shot clock, just finding ways to beat defenses and continue to work, even though they're trying to take you away. And he just kept coming and coming and coming. It was a phenomenal performance. But my question here is, Michael, on this blindsided aspect for Boston, let's say they did go out in five. After all of this, and certainly I looked at them as a championship caliber team after they took that 3-2 lead over Toronto. You look at the two rosters, and certainly coming into the series, both of us thought that Boston was better. You could have an argument that Boston's still better at this point of the series, although that's getting a little bit harder to make that case as this unfolds and they struggle, especially in big moments late. I'm curious, how big of a disappointment would it be if Boston goes down in five? I mean, no one's getting fired, right? This isn't like a Milwaukee Bucks or a Clippers situation, but that doesn't really feel good enough for this Boston Celtics team, does it? Or are you saying, you know what, the hay is already in the barn. We got through Toronto. We made the conference finals. Everything's hunky-dory. We're going to be back. We're young. I mean, what's your takeaway if Boston does lose this thing in five?
I don't think it's even close to as disastrous as the Bucks loss or as the Clippers loss, because you just look at how those teams were constructed and what their futures are. It's just like a completely different situation. Boston's super young. Their best player is 22 years old. They have Jaylen Brown locked up for the foreseeable future.
So point taken, but there's stuff left on the table, right? I mean, you're not happy.
Yeah.
And there's going to be a segment of the fan base that really wants Brad Stevens' job, right? I mean, there's going to be people who are angry, I guess is my point. Some of those green beer Celtics fans are going to be overflowing with rage.
No, look, the Miami Heat are a five seed, right? And the team, I think, that was the five seed during the regular season is a little different than this team in the bubble for a variety of reasons. I mean, you have Bam starting at the five, completely shifting just who they are and what they're able to do in the lineups that they play. And obviously Tyler Hero just coming on as this chainsaw massacre, as you said. But no, I thought that, and I still do think that the Celtics are perfectly capable of coming back for a variety of reasons that we can get into. But if they do lose in five or they lose in six, it's super disappointing. I mean, no question about it. There was really no reason for them to blow game two the way they did. There was no reason for, there was emotional baggage potentially on both sides before game four. But the first half of game four, I don't know what it felt like in the gym, Ben, but on television, that was so similar to watching like a Pistons-Hornets game in the middle of January. There was just no energy whatsoever. And maybe that's just because of the way some of the best players on the floor were playing, including Jason Tatum, who just looked hurt for the first half. Like, honestly, just like physically hobbled, which you can't really say is the case because he had 28 in the second half and he looked pretty, he was moving a lot better, particularly on the defensive end. So yeah, it, like to answer your question, it would be a mega disappointment, particularly like the Clippers are out, the Bucks, they didn't have to go through the Bucks. The Raptors were such a formidable opponent that really tested them. And to get through that team, you kind of thought that the finals, they were in the clear to go to the finals. So to lose the way that they have, not to take anything against the Miami Heat, but against a team that, you know, has one traditional all-star caliber player wing in Jimmy Butler who could really damage you. And for Jimmy to not even go off in this series and for you to still lose in five would be, that would be humiliating.
Yeah, not to mention this is probably Boston's last best shot at a title, right, Michael? I mean, with this group. Look, I'm messing with you. I do think it's actually a pretty big disappointment. I mean, it's not a disaster by any stretch, and it's the kind that I actually think people would get over quickly. But if they go down in five, there's going to be some real meltdowns online. And I'm already hearing from a few Celtics fans I talk to where they're just trying to figure out, like, who can they blame? Like, who's the fall guy? And I think in this situation, like, a lot of it just boils down to Tyler Hero was absolutely ridiculous. He had the game of his life. His game is absolutely perfectly suited for the bubble. So is his personality. It's a lot like Jamal Murray, where these guys only care about basketball. They're really creative off the dribble. They've got deep bags. They've got the green light here. They're feeling it because there's no crowd pressure, and they're just going nuts. My favorite stat from game four was the bench scoring, Michael. Miami wins the bench scoring 40-22, and Hero had 37. Thanks for the shot, Andre Iguodala, to kind of chip in there and help with that advantage. I mean, just an incredible line there. So when I'm looking at Boston, and we're saying what went wrong in that first half, I mean, first of all, you're saying what did it feel like in the gym? I mean, it felt like watching a ghost movie. I don't know, Casper or something like that. I mean, you had number zero just jogging around out there, not doing anything. I mean, just passing up every shot. I didn't really see the injury stuff that I know some people were getting, you know, building that buzz, and you just mentioned that. Part of it is that he stretches so much before games, Tatum does, that he looks like the most limber superstar. He can pretty much kick his foot above his head. Have you ever seen him do that? It's almost
no,
like,
I haven't.
Yeah, he like has this very intense stretching routine. Everybody else is shooting jumpers and he goes and stretches for like 10 minutes. So he can like kick his foot above his head basically at will. So I think anyone who can do that actually is not injured. I think it's impossible to do that if you're injured, basically. So my personal diagnosis was that he was
fine.
That's
your medical opinion?
Yeah, he was just shook. That's my analysis. He just didn't want the moment. I mean, he just kept passing the ball. He wasn't you know, really seeking out his own offense. He looked like he was in a blur. That happens. You know, Brad Stevens' comment after the game is like, hey, look, that's basketball. Sometimes guys adjust after halftime and they lock themselves in. Sometimes they're not there. Of course, the timing of not being there is really questionable. What happened? And then was it in relation to the delay? I mean, they did break their routine for the first time in a long time of not playing every other day with that extended break. Did that hurt him? I guess that's one possible explanation. Or maybe we find out there is something going on. What led you to believe he was hurt? Like, were there symptoms? Was he favoring something? Why did you reach that conclusion? Or was it just the fact that he was horrible in the biggest game of the season?
So, I mean, he had 28 in the second half. Let's tone it down a little
I was going to ask you on that. Was that the worst 28-point performance in NBA history when you consider how it played out? I mean, honestly. Like, if you really think about it, it's hard to have a bad 28. But to me, like, he is the fall guy for game four. And there's other guys you can blame for sure. Kemba was getting...
I have some other fall guys. But to answer your question, this goes back to game two and just his energy level in that game. And there was this one play where, you know, Jimmy... Well, on one of Jimmy's pick sixes, he had, like, 17 of them. But on one of them, Tatum, like, was at midcourt and did not run back to... just defend the play at all. And there was a moment where it looked like Jimmy was going to, like, I forget who it was, maybe Smart was going to actually steal it back. And so he was just kind of standing at midcourt, and that's an energy thing. I was also just hearing from different people who, you know, would potentially know that he might be injured or playing through a physical ailment. And there was this one play actually where, so I guess, like, let me back up for 2 seconds. So I wrote this piece about his step back jumper and his step back three and how effective it is and how he can basically go to it whenever he wants. And after I wrote that piece, he basically stopped. I think he maybe has attempted one since then.
It's so amazing. Now, is it a confidence and pressure thing, or is it a physical thing? Because that's something that we see with much lesser shooters, you know, Giannis, DeMar DeRozan. Once they actually hit the point where they start to feel pressure, those perimeter weapons disappear, right?
This dude is not Giannis or DeMar DeRozan. This dude is maybe one of the best step back 3-point shooters in the NBA at a very high volume.
But every player faces pressure, I guess, is my point. Okay. And so if he's hitting the pressure point deep in the Eastern Conference Finals and DeMar DeRozan is hitting the pressure point in game one of the first round, that's sort of where the comparison comes in, right?
Okay. So there was this one play where he attempts a step back 3 over Hero at the end of the second quarter in game 2. And there was like 4 seconds left on the clock or something, and Miami got the rebound and was able to kind of push it a little bit and get like a half court heave. And after Tatum missed the shot, he bent over and put his hands on his knees as if he was in physical pain, as opposed to finishing out the play. And I thought that I watched that play and I was like, that's a strange reaction for someone to have before the whistle, before the buzzer sounds. I was just like, it was very confusing. I don't know what's going on with him. I don't want to give excuses or anything like that.
No, that's interesting. You do sound like a soccer dad right now where you're like, oh no, Billy, did you sprain your ankle on that cross? But that's interesting. I had not noticed that. Anyway, continue.
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, this is like all conjecture and not fact-based, so maybe we can move on from that. But I want to – can we talk about, like, other fall guys?
Oh, for sure. If you want to shift the blame, by all means, we can certainly do that. So I saw a couple guys who I thought, especially late in that game, maybe got picked on or exposed. I mean, it seems like Kemba's having a really rough series. I know Stevens took him from the game at one point in the fourth quarter. I think maybe we had predicted that coming into the playoffs, but to see it in that moment was jarring for sure, I would say. And then I also think Hayward, again, not to kind of beat this dead horse because I was going off about this on the last podcast, you know, he's helpful for sure. You're glad he's out there. But at certain moments, he also was getting beat. I mean, I think of that layup that Dragic got past him in the paint and a few other situations where maybe he's a half step slow. And you mentioned this idea of, you know, maybe whether it's fatigue or whatever else sinking in. I think both teams really look tired, and I think that was kind of the difference late in the game. I mean, remember that wide open three that Dragic got in the left corner? You know, one of the daggers before they nearly, you know, kissed the whole game away late with the crazy fouls and all that stuff.
Can I talk about that play for 2 seconds?
Please. Was it fatigue or did I miss something?
No, I mean, that came off. So the Celtics were small, I believe, in that possession. Maybe Tice was on the floor hiding out on Crowder or whoever. I don't think Crowder was in the game, but he was hiding out somewhere if he was in the game. And so it was basically a switch situation because Gordon and Tatum, I believe, were defending, or Gordon and Jaylen were defending Bam and Jimmy Butler, who were running a pick and roll. And in that spot, you switch. That's why you're small. That's the whole point. You've got these rangy wings. That's what you do. And instead, they trap Jimmy Butler for no reason. So Jimmy hits Bam. Bam is in a 4-on-3. Bam forces the defender out of the corner, who would be on Dragic, and finds Dragic in the corner for the wide open three. And it was like, this is so, like, I think Brad Stevens is a great coach. I have a very hard time believing that that was what they were supposed to execute on that play.
It was very Warriors-esque with the tic-tac-toe passing to find that shooter. What stuck out to me is that throughout a lot of the series, when you're in that situation, there would inevitably be a Celtics player sprinting out hard to that shooter, right? And it just felt like that was the moment they broke. There was nobody within 15 feet. It was the most open shot they've conceded maybe the entire playoffs, right? And that was
for sure.
That was where I was like, all right, well, they screwed the scheme up, right? But they also, that was the backbreaker. That was that moment where it was like nobody could dig deep to chase 20 feet to go, you know, put a hand up. It was kind of like that was the possession they gave up.
No, and I don't even think there was a point to trying to close out if you're 15 feet. You know what I mean? Like the play crumbled when like the point of attack was what they decided to do at the point of attack. But so like I think Brad Stevens is a really good coach, and I mean he was like trending on Twitter last night and this morning, and he's getting killed for a lot of the decisions that he's made. That one was very. Just, I don't know if the players decided to do that on their own or what it was, because they were switching. They've been switching throughout basically the whole series. So I don't know. That would have been a really weird time to do something like that.
They just broke down, man. I'm sorry. Like, I understand what you're saying, but I think that they just folded. They got too tired. It became too much. And that's the moment that they died on the vine. So who's your fall guy, Kemba? If it's not Brad and it's not Tatum, who are you blaming here?
Well, I think that, you know, Marcus Smart had a terrible game.
Holy cow, he did. You know, I've been calling him an elite shot misser for years, and he's been proving me wrong a lot in these playoffs, but that was an elite shot misser performance. I mean, if you want to talk about clutch misses, big time misses, bad misses, you know, like clanging them off the back of the rim far.
Ooh. Okay, so for me, it's never really about whether he makes or he misses that I criticize, because I think he's a fine shooter. He's average to good at this point in his career. I think the bigger thing is in having an understanding of when it is the right time to pull the trigger. And one of his threes late in the game, early clock, it was semi-contested, and he just pulls up from the left wing above the break. When the Celtics are, you know, they have momentum and they're trying to come back and regain the lead in a really close game. And he pulls the trigger and it's like not even close. And it's like, you're what, 2 for whatever from the floor? I don't think he even made a three. Maybe he made 1 3. I'm not even looking at the box score, but I can't remember him making a three game.
It was 1 for 8. Let me ask you, I'm going to give you 3 choices of a player, okay?
Sure.
You can have Michael Jordan. You can have LeBron James. Or you can have Jason Tatum with Marcus Smart's confidence. Which player do you take?
Yeah, that's a hell of a player. I mean, I always do this exercise with, like, what would player X look like if he had Russell Westbrook's brain? So, that's funny. But can I just... I do have another criticism.
Please, bring him out. Trust me. There is nothing the Open Floor Globe wants to hear more than anguish Celtics self-loathing. So keep it coming.
Okay, so Tyler Hero is just bludgeoning you over the head, right? And every time he lets go of the ball, you feel like it's going in. Like, I don't think I'm the only person who felt that way. I'm sure you did too. I'm sure a lot of other people did. And a lot of his possessions, especially the ones where he's actually trying to score, Kemba Walker is his defender. I'm just like, I understand that the Celtics are weary of Goran Dragic and the performance he had in Game 1 at the end down the stretch, and for parts of Game 2 where he's just a really, you know, effective offensive player who gives you a lot of problems. So they've primarily had Marcus Smart on Goran Dragic, and he's done a really good job shutting him down ever since. But last night it was like Tyler Hero is just like dousing you in gasoline. It's maybe time to take Kemba Walker off of him. Just a thought.
Yeah, great matchup there. Loved it.
and put Marcus Smart on him. You know, if that forces the Miami Heat to transition away from Hero and go to Dragic and let Dragic try to attack Kemba or whatever what they want to do, like there were like a lot of shots that Hero made that were just like you got to tip your cap, but at the same time, you also should be making adjustments on the fly in the game. And I thought that eventually, you know, they put Jaylen on him eventually, but it's like it's, they waited so long. I mean, the guy had 37. Like, it's just you got to. He needs to be like the number one offensive player on your scouting report right now for the rest of the series. Like, I don't care. Like, he is diabolical. It's like So that was just very confounding to me, and I had to get that one off my chest.
I'm glad you used that phrase, tip your hat, because it really did feel like, you know, as that was unfolding, Stevens and everybody had a choice, and it was like, look, do you bet that the 20-year-old rookie is going to actually do this and beat you, or do you expect him to come back to earth at least somewhat, and, you know, you can keep the rest of your defense as is, locked down on the guys who were supposed to be Miami's main guys, and find a way to gut it out. And it felt like he went with the second solution. And, you know, ultimately, like, he spent half of his post-game press conference tipping his hat to Tyler Hero, saying, yeah, his shot-making was the difference and everything else. I mean, that they just went down with that ship. I know that the Celtics have a mascot named Lucky the Leprechaun who does wear a hat.
Oh,
could we possibly do an alternate logo of Lucky where he tips his hat to Tyler Hero, and maybe that could be like a new logo for that 2020-2021 season? What do you think, Michael?
This household does not acknowledge Lucky. he is an abomination. You should not, like, I forget if we've ever talked about this, but you should not. He's my least favorite, like, thing about, I'm sure he's a nice person. He's my least favorite thing about the Celtics organization. I just, if you're a mascot, you're a mascot. You're not like a white guy. That can't, like, it just, like, that can't be what's going on here. I don't know what's taking them so long to change that. It's terrible. I hate it so much. Thank you for bringing up Lucky and ruining my day.
You're very welcome. And I'd also say, when Boston plays small in the clutch, they remind me of a group of leprechauns. That's all I will add to that point. All right, Michael, when we look back on this Celtics series, is there a turning point moment? Was it this game four? Was it something within this game four? Was it just Hero's explosion that we're going to say, all right, this is where it was lost? Or are you, by the way, still holding out hope for Celtics in seven? Because we did get a couple Celtics in seven emails, and I want to know, are you in that camp?
No, I don't think that the series is over by any stretch. The Celtics still have a lot of really good players. I think that they, you know, I wouldn't say that they've solved the zone by any means. That would be a foolish thing to say, because it's still pretty effective and was effective in big spots down the stretch last night. But these games have been super close, man. Like, it could easily have, this series could basically be, besides game three, it could be a sweep for the Celtics. It could be it could be 3-1 Miami. It could be tied. It could be, so, like, I think that you look at the point differential, I think it's like exact on the money where both teams are tied with the same net rating, which is pretty funny. So no, I don't think that the Miami Heat have this incredible advantage that has led me to believe they are the better team and they are superior and that they will win in five or six. I don't think that. I still think that, particularly in the bubble, where, like, there's no home court as a factor, and I wonder, like, how much, I know I'm rambling a little bit, but, like, how much home court affects someone like Tyler Hero on a night like that? You know what I mean? Like, as the game is progressing, he's going on and he's feeling more comfortable, and there's nothing to jibe his rhythm at all that you would otherwise have if he was in Boston or even if he was in Miami.
No, I think it's true. Both him and Jamal Murray just keep showing it, and especially Murray, where if you do get hot, I mean, here's what I would love to see. You know, this whole debate about, oh, the hot hand, like, does the hot hand exist? I've always just been kind of an old school dude who's like, all right, save the research papers. Like, I personally got hot like three times during my basketball career, so I therefore believe in the hot hand for my entire life. I would love for a guy like Tyler Hero to come out during his post-game press conference and be like, you know, I understand there's a lot of debate back and forth both sides about whether the hot hand exists, but I just want to say that I settled it for once and for all. It does actually exist. I just proved it. Thank you very much and have a good day. And then walk off.
It definitely exists.
Can you imagine if MIT and how they would respond to that? It'd be so funny. But no, I think you're right. I think that these conditions are absolutely ideal for scores. No travel, plenty of rest time, same gym, same hoops. There was a while there where they were using multiple gyms for some of these series. So like you would go back and forth between what they call the field house and the arena. Now they're playing in strictly the arena. There's no noise. There's no real distractions. Hero actually has a cheering section. He's by far the favorite player of the Miami Heat wives and girlfriends. They all just go nuts for him and children. So like he does get some positive reinforcement. And by the way, I think he's pretty much the favorite player of the media section too. I mean, he had a lot of people oohing and aahing as he was going nuts last night. This brings me to my final question for this section, Michael. And it's a little bit of a curveball. I'm curious, where does Hero rank for you as like an all-time Celtics antagonist or opponent? And I ask this question. Here's why I ask it. And look, this series is not over. I don't want to rush to it. And certainly, I'm with you. Boston's not going to go down without a fight. And Miami, by the way, was bracing for it. That's what they were saying in their post-game press conference. Like, we know what these guys are about. Mm-hmm. It's only going to get tougher to close them out. But if you go back a couple of years, do you remember Kelly Olynyk's just ridiculous Game 7 against the Washington Wizards? Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Washington Wizards fans were scarred for life by that Kelly Olynyk performance, right? And so, like, they will always, always associate Kelly Olynyk with, like, their deepest possible pain. So I'm curious, when you're looking at, like, you know, recent postseasons for Boston, like, where does Hero stack up? And who are some of the other guys that pop to your mind as, like, God, that guy killed us?
LeBron James, Kyrie Irving. No, I it's like
nothing but Hall of Fame company for Tyler Hero.
No, but actually, I wanted to find out just how ridiculous this was historically for Hero. And you mentioned the Magic Johnson stat, but I went a little deeper with it, and I wanted to know, you know, what rookie off the bench? How many rookies off the bench have scored at least 30 in the playoffs? And there were five guys in history, including Hero, and three total, so two other guys, did it against the Celtics, which is pretty cool, I guess, or terrible, depending on what your point of view is. And so Andrew Toney, in 1981, game two of the conference finals, drops 35, seven boards, seven assists, makes no threes, which is and only attempts one, which is obviously just a sign of the times. And Jeff Roulon, who scored 33 in not the conference finals, and both of those games were losses too, which just like even more so just like is painful because Hero 37, 36 minutes, unstoppable. Game four, like. Yeah, so historically, you know, if the Celtics go on to lose this series, I think that Hero's performance will potentially be what I remember the most. And obviously, there's a lot of basketball to be played. I also just am more, it's just like how my brain works. Like when you're the favorite, and I thought that the Celtics coming into the series should have been considered the favorite. You got to look at like what the Celtics did wrong a little bit more than what happened on the other side, and to control what you can control. And they haven't done a good job of controlling what they can control. And I put a lot of that on, I think Brad is a great coach. I put some of it on him, like Grant Williams not really playing in game four. That's weird. I don't understand that. And some of the defensive matchups that we discussed earlier, some of the strategies stuff that we discussed earlier. So Hero is for sure up there historically. I don't really know who else in terms of just like people who've broken my heart.
Here's your research project. If the Celtics do lose by the next episode, I'm going to want a top five Celtics heartbreakers, and we can go through and really dig deep into your
it's
pain.
It's really...
here's what I would say too, Michael, like, you know, I've noticed that as well when I dig through Basketball Reference that there's a lot of matchups against the Celtics, like you're saying, Andrew Toney. I mean, they always pop up as like the antagonist. I've certainly noticed that. I mean, I think that's one of the things about having such a long and glorious track record as a franchise. I just have noticed, though, that there's fewer comparison points if you dig in like kind of and just really drill down to like final stats. Like you rarely see the Celtics, especially in the modern era, pop up in those. I'm not sure why that is. I guess it's just they come up short a lot. Maybe they just go out in the second and third round a little bit. But yeah, other than that, I do see them in a lot of those comparisons.
Yeah, I will say I'm just going to ignore everything that you just said. But I will say that Jeff Green in the 2018 Eastern Conference Finals.
Oh, that's a great
game
one.
Seven. That's one that I'm just never. Everyone talks about all the missed threes and Terry Rozier. I will never get over Jeff Green, who was a former Celtic and
the
he was
least
very
reliable
painful.
Player of all time, right? Like he's the anti-hero.
Painful.
He's the anti-hero.
Exactly. He's the anti-hero in a lot of ways, pun intended. And I remember I tweeted before that game, like, I don't even know why I did this, but I tweeted something very negative about Jeff Green just because I'm not a nice person. And then he goes out and he just rips the heart out of my chest. So I deserve that one. But that one also sticks with me.
All right, let's shift gears here quickly and discuss the Breonna Taylor ruling. Now, obviously, that came down on Wednesday, I think early afternoon perhaps or somewhere around there. And it was definitely felt in all quarters of the bubble, and I'm sure everywhere across the country. You heard Nuggets coach Michael Malone discuss it. You heard the Lakers and Danny Green discuss their team reaction. You heard before the game both Spoelstra and Brad Stevens discuss it. There was some questioning, like, just in my own mind and actually of those coaches, like, were these guys going to take the court? I mean, at that point, you know, we're deeper, the stakes are higher in the playoffs, but you could also understand guys, you know, being so demoralized by that news that they just didn't want to play. We saw that earlier a few weeks. I think that was still fresh on everyone's mind. Once mm-hmm. I got to the arena, all that kind of talk went to the side. Everybody was going through warm-ups like normal, and it seemed like they were good to go. We found out later that, you know, a guy like Tatum and Brown essentially said, look, we were prepared for the worst. You know, it's not like we were surprised here. You know, we're sad, but like mm-hmm. we kind of saw where this was going, and that probably contributed to the decision to play. When you were watching the reactions, LeBron James chimed in on Twitter, Jamal Crawford, DeMarcus Cousins, you know, a number of people had strong words both inside the bubble and outside the bubble. You know, what was your day like yesterday? How did you process, you know, everything that was said from the NBA players? And did anybody's comments really stick out to you?
Yeah, I mean, me personally, it's just super deflating. As you said, it is expected. I don't think anyone who's been living in this country or has been following this case or following the history of police officers and how they are held accountable for their actions would be surprised by yesterday's decision not to indict on any charges of murder the people who murdered Breonna Taylor. But it's still just it's like an insult almost to like the senses and to charge one officer for shooting in a neighboring apartment. Wanton endangerment, I think, is what the charge was, and not charging the officers who killed a human being is truly unbelievable. But everyone that you said, I took note of, every NBA player and coach. I want to highlight one you didn't mention, Mike Malone with the Nuggets, and I just am so impressed by his eloquence in addressing social injustice throughout this entire bubble experience. So I just wanted to shout him out, and him just explicitly saying, you know, we have not gotten justice, and that's a shame. And just hearing someone say those words out loud is always meaningful to me. His decision to put himself in Kenneth Walker's shoes. Kenneth Walker was Breonna Taylor's boyfriend who shot one of the police officers when they came into his apartment. And just that's just empathy. That is if more people tried to put themselves in other people's shoes, the world would be such a better place. So it was really nice to hear him frame it that way. So I want to just applaud him really quickly. And then,
oh yeah, and by the way, real quick, he also tied mm-hmm. that case to the Elijah McClain case
yes.
in Colorado, which is one that he's been advocating on, you know, on behalf of for the entire bubble, you know, and also for him, I'm sure that's frustrating because his megaphone is big here, especially now that he's in the conference finals, but it's not even big relative to other NBA personalities, right? I mean, I think that Michael Malone, I call him a little bit of a grandstander because he gets out there in front of the microphone and knows exactly what he's going to say. He's trying to make points. When he said he wanted families in the bubble for coaches, he let everybody know, including Adam Silver, right? But he's also the coach of the Denver Nuggets, and I think he actually joked that nobody listens to his coach's show that he does back in Denver because someone had mentioned it on a Zoom call that they had just heard his interview. And he's like, really? You must be the only person that listens to it. So for him, it's got to be like triply frustrating, right? Because you're never getting the feedback of like, oh, yeah, you know, this guy is really leading on this issue, or like you're trying to build momentum to Elijah McClain. And it's like ultimately, you know, the name that people were really focused on throughout the bubble was Breonna Taylor. I went back through my stories from the last couple of months. It's unbelievable how many times players mentioned her, either in interviews or in other advocacy issues. And for Michael Malone to have one that he really cares passionately about, he can't get people's attention to, or doesn't feel like he's necessarily breaking through. That's really tough. And I admired his ability in that moment to take what was obviously a negative and try to spin it forward as well as he possibly could. And you know, I think it got us talking about it. So yeah, in that case, yeah, he's successful.
Yeah, for sure. And I think what's really fascinating about Breonna Taylor's case in particular is just how her name has come to symbolize just police brutality in a way that specific cases, other specific cases and instances have not. And so when all the players are using her name and advocating for justice, it's about her 100% and it's about her case, but it's also about so much more. And when you're as focused as they, as the players and the coaches have been, trying to find justice, for her and for her family, for that to just not work out at all, despite the pressure that you have attempted to put using the platform and using the bubble, I just can't imagine, even though it was very predictable and foreseeable, I can't imagine how frustrating that must feel for the players inside the bubble. So even though it was expected in a way that, you know, in a way that Jacob Blake's shooting is not expected. You didn't know that this was planned. We knew that there was going to be an announcement this week. It's still just, it must be very difficult for them to deal with and to cope with.
I think the reason why the Breonna Taylor case stuck with so many players, it was this idea that there was no possible method for her to protect herself, right? I mean, this wasn't a situation where, hey, if she had only handled things differently with a police officer, you know, if she had only followed the instructions like getting out of the car, or if, you know, she had only done X, Y, and Z, maybe something else would have been different. You know, in this case, it's the idea that even if you're at home, you're still a potential target and still a potential victim and could find yourself on the wrong side of a system that doesn't necessarily care about your well-being and or doesn't necessarily prioritize it. And I think LeBron has, you know, talked, he's used language like, you know, we feel hunted by the guns in America. You know, I think he's also had a long statement on Twitter yesterday about black women and how they are sort of, you know, taken advantage of by society or always kept last, you know, for everything, and how he was trying to kind of highlight them and prop them up as queens, right? To try to reverse that narrative. It's got to be, you know, putting yourself in these player situations, especially when you're detached from your own families, it's got to be just so heartbreaking. And the feeling of helplessness and a lack of answers, I do think that's why this particular case resonated with them so much. And I actually think, in hindsight, they wanted more, obviously. And I loved that Tyler Herro was the one to say that money is not justice. You know, there was a $12 million settlement with the family. So I'm sure the city or the authorities look at it like, well, hey, they didn't go home empty-handed. But, you know, certainly from the reaction from the players, you could realize that's not what they wanted. I mean, the money, people will always accept money, but that was not the ultimate goal. But I think when the players kind of look back on this, it will be a long-term advocacy project that I think will inspire future projects among NBA players and WNBA players going forward. I think that they will look at this perhaps as a setback, but also as something where they completely changed the conversation around her and raised it and kept it in the news and kept people tweeting about it for months. And they should not view that as, you know, being, you know, something that that had no dividends. Like, for example, I saw LeBron and Donovan Mitchell apologizing to the family, right? I'm so sorry. I can't believe this happened. And I understand that sentiment. They must feel, you know, maybe some level of guilt, or like they came up short, or like, you know, they're athletes. They're used to winning. And anytime they lose, those kinds of feelings are going to come through. I think putting myself in the position of the family or their attorneys, I would basically say, why are you apologizing? You know, thank you so much for what you guys did. And, you know, you're not to blame here. And I think ultimately they'll, when there's more time and distance, I hope they're going to be able to take that lesson, that even though they didn't get what they wanted in this particular situation, it was a very powerful push.
Yeah, 100%. And I actually just did an interview with Chris Webber to talk about the viral emotional monologue that he gave about a month ago on the day that the Milwaukee Bucks decided to sit out their game and the NBA season kind of stopped. And one of the things that he said that stuck with me is that players, the actions that the players have made in the bubble, you know, it's unrealistic to expect overnight change from basically anything that they do. But the whole value there is to inspire the next generation of players and the next generation of just people in this country to see people in power who have money and know that it affects them as well, and that it's okay to speak out and stand up for what you believe in. And so I thought that that was really an interesting thing, an interesting point to make going forward.
Absolutely. And everybody check that story out. I'll be sure to go give that a read as well, Michael. Hey, let's dig into the Western Conference Finals here a little bit. And then we've got some rapid fire questions at the end to get through, which is always dangerous because that means this could be a 2-hour podcast. But we got a question from Luke. He writes, I was shocked by Ben's disrespect for my countryman, Daniel Theis, in the last episode. What he does in this series is intelligent load management with the foul trouble. Why should he waste his strength now when he needs to go head-to-head against Anthony Davis in 2 weeks? I'm glad that Michael the Podpina stepped in before it got really ugly. Hopefully Luke's kidding on some of that stuff. He continues, I couldn't stay mad at Ben for long because immediately afterwards on that episode, his nickname for Nikola Jokic, the Hypotenuse King, was legendary. I am quite disappointed, though, that the nickname is still not listed on Basketball Reference. That could be a long wait, Luke. I'm not sure that one's going to catch on, although I am a little bit proud of it, hence why I read this email. In any case, he asks, in June or July, there was a lot of talk that the 2020 NBA champion would be marked with an asterisk in the history books because of all the circumstances. A lot of things are different, to be fair. I feel like the level of these games, though, is so high, and we have seen so many highlights already, that there really won't be much talk about an asterisk when the finals are over. In hindsight, the talk about the asterisk was a bit overblown, and the champion will not be evaluated differently. They will be the same as all champions before and after. What do you think? So, Michael, just quickly, I know that you were pretty pro-asterisk talk before we got here. Do you buy what he's selling, or do you still view this as one that will be treated differently?
I mean, no, I'm not going to sway away from this. I still think there will be an asterisk, but as I said before, when we were recording episodes in June and July, like, an asterisk doesn't have to be quote-unquote lesser than. It just simply labels something as different or an outlier than all the championships and the playoff runs that
I love it. You're rebranding. You're rebranding the asterisk. I love it.
Yeah, no, that's what it is. So, like, you know, there's no home court advantage, obviously, for teams like the Clippers and teams like the Milwaukee Bucks. There's no, or, you know, Raptors fans will say the same thing about not having Game 7, which is what they fought for the whole regular season, not having Game 7 in Toronto. Instead, they have to play the Celtics on a neutral court. There's no fans, and we discussed what that would mean to someone like Jamal Murray or someone like Tyler Hero, who is just completely unaffected by the crowds. How it, the there not being any crowds impacts refereeing also is something that we haven't discussed on this particular episode, but I think is a real thing that needs to be studied. And then obviously COVID and players in the bubble have test. There's a lot of players in the bubble who have tested positive before they came down. And I'm working on a story right now and reporting out just kind of what the impact is of testing positive for COVID and having COVID and then playing professional basketball weeks later and what that does to the body and what we know about it. And so there are certainly instances where, like, you know, Nikola Jokic looks great. Bam Adebayo tested positive. Also, he's looked great. But like the timing and the circumstances and every case is different. And so I think we talked about this earlier, but like in an earlier episode, but like Russell Westbrook, his situation where you test positive and you can't, I don't think people understand that, like, when you test positive for COVID, you can't do anything physically because of the impact that we know it has on the heart, or potential risk it has on the heart. So you just sit there, and that messes, as a professional athlete, that does a lot to your body that we don't know as not medical professionals or physical trainers or anything like that. But it does a lot, and it has an impact. And we saw it with Westbrook. We saw it with Montrezl Harrell, who just was like 50% of the Montrezl Harrell who won the Sixth Man of the Year award during the regular season. So, like, yeah, I think that it's like all this stuff is really unique to this season. So to not put an asterisk doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. And again, I don't think it has to be a negative. It's just obviously different than any other season that has come prior.
I guess the way I would split this difference is say that people will remember 2020 as the bubble title, right? But I don't necessarily think it's going to be viewed in a negative connotation. Being here now for more than 2 months, we have set into the marathon stage of this thing where, like, you know, we're on mile 20, 21, and it's become a ghost town. There's a lot fewer people here. It does feel like we're all the last people at the party, right? And it's just kind of like, when's this bar going to close? Anytime soon? Like, nobody wants to go home, like the last few stragglers, right? And I do think that the main takeaway from whoever wins this will be that they were the ones who outlasted everybody else. The kings of the mountain, the last ones standing. They deserve to win it simply because they were willing to stay for 3 months and get it done and continue to play at a high level and kind of, you know, hold off all comers. And, you know, through a lot of trying mental, emotional, physical, psychological challenges. So I do think that that will help validate them. I do think it will help reduce the talk of an asterisk in a negative way, you know, to Luke's question. But I do think it's always going to be remembered as the bubble title. And that's why you should buy my forthcoming book, Michael, Bubble Ball, which is now available on Amazon.
I was waiting for that.
Yeah. Okay. Let's get into the Western Conference Finals questions. Zach writes, game one was not an indicator of how this series is going to go. Jokic was sidelined by the refs. Game two was the first game that the Nuggets could even begin to figure out how to play the Lakers, and they got it all the way down to the final shot. You could see in Game 3 they did a great job of figuring out the Lakers' defense. Jokic was playing well. Murray was great down the stretch. I still think Michael Lapodpina's pick of Nuggets in 7 is a real possibility. Could this be the Jokic and Murray show from Zach? I was blown away by Murray's closing effort in game 3. I want to just, you know, plug a story that I wrote about that. It was such a classic moment where no matter how much the point guard position evolves and we throw all these layers of cool tricks with ball handling and, you know, shooting from 40 feet and everything else, it was just a reminder that, like, the fundamental task of a point guard is to create order for his team and then to restore order if necessary or when necessary mm-hmm. during a game. And they go 6 possessions in a row, Michael, with turnovers. This is chaos. I haven't seen that since middle school. 6 turnovers in a row, back to back mm-hmm. to back to back to back. And somebody needs to just kind of like put the team on his back, calm them down, and take over. And it was Murray hitting a 3. It was Murray with the beautiful no-look twisting pass to Millsap for the dunk. And then it was Murray with another 3 to close that thing out for Denver in the Western Conference Finals, outshining both LeBron James and Anthony Davis in that moment. And by the way, not being afraid to step on Nikola Jokic's big toes, because that, you know, it has been his team, and he's been awesome both within this series at times, but also throughout this playoff run too. Monster, monster performance from a young point guard, and he's been labeled as inconsistent the whole way. He might be the most consistent player in the bubble, if you really think about it, in terms of the quality of his play night to night has just been insane. The night and day contrast from last year to this year and the personal growth from him has been one of the best stories. And I think when I look back on this bubble experience and I say, well, what really defined it? Well, there was lots of just whimsy, right? It was a weird place. It was kind of goofy. You had to adjust to it. There was lots of offensive explosions that were memorable, but there was also these daily tests of will where, like, every single day you had to wake up and go through all these routines just to even pass the COVID clearance, and then you had to go out and do your job night after night after night. The guy who embodies all of those elements, the whimsy, the scoring, the excitement, the unpredictability, overcoming the test of will time after time, to me, it's Jamal Murray. I'm not saying he's the best player in the bubble. I'm saying he is the bubble, okay? He's not the bubble MVP. Jamal Murray is the bubble.
I think it's kind of potentially fair to say that he's the best player in the bubble. Like, I'm not, I don't even think that's hyperbolic.
A heater.
No, I mean, like, obviously LeBron James is in the bubble. Anthony Davis is in the bubble. There are great players in the bubble, for sure. I know that. Jamal Murray, like, you plugged your story. It was a really good read. Everyone should check it out. I agree with everything that you said. I'm going to plug something that I wrote for 538 earlier this week, where I looked at Murray's numbers throughout this playoff run and compared them to Steph Curry's numbers throughout the 2015 championship run. And, like, look, I'm not saying that Jamal Murray...
Can I spoil it?
Yeah, you sure you can?
They were pretty close, weren't they?
They were pretty close. and I will say, like, Murray, obviously Steph, if you go back and look at Steph's numbers, they're just so silly. Like, he attempted 11 threes a game in that run. Like, that's just not... that's still not a human thing that people do. And made like 45% of them or something like that.
Well, that was just Murray, a great time for basketball because nobody knew what you were supposed to do to defend someone who shot 11 threes. So it was like, hey, keep shooting. Now everybody knows that you've got to pick up and where you have to pick up and everything
100%.
Else. 100%. So it's a totally different sport.
That's a great point. And that's something that I also covered in the piece, which is like you can never – it's impossible to compare someone to Curry in 2015 because it was so unprecedented and it was so revolutionary. So everyone that comes after that is like in his wake, and defenses have adapted over the past 5 years and lineups have adapted and the types of players that teams sign and play big minutes has changed to kind of prevent guys like Curry from going off. So for Murray, who's averaging like he's shooting like 48% from the 3-point line in the playoffs on like 8 attempts a night, like that is insane. And a vast majority of them are pull up threes. And that pull up three he hit two down the stretch with 3 minutes to go in that game. One of them was just like this absurd dribble move where he completely shook Alex Caruso out of his shoes and like drilled it from the top of the key. The next one was like a 35-footer that was just very, very Steph. Like that is the one where he's like shimmying back down the court.
Right. Well, that shot was so great because he isolated on Anthony Davis, where like if you're talking about having length, quickness, the ability to guard on the perimeter, like what modern big man in that situation do you want instead of Anthony Davis, right? Like this was not Timofey Mozgov getting trapped on an island against Steph Curry, right? This is, you know, skill on skill. And Murray's like, okay, I'm going to back up an extra two steps and just firebomb this thing from 35 feet right in your face, swish.
Yeah, so just like Jamal Murray is just breaking people's brains in the same way that Steph did. And so if you have a guy like that who's like, if this is the new Jamal Murray, then like, I don't think that the Nuggets should be the favorites in this series quite yet. You know, they're trailing 2-1 still, even though game two was just like a debacle of epic proportions and they should have won that game. But if you have Jamal Murray and Jamal Murray is suddenly Steph Curry, which he has been in this run, in this short sample size, then all bets are off. And LeBron knows exactly how it feels to go up against someone like that who is just completely irrepressible. And there's really nothing you can do when he has it going. So, like, yeah, shout out to Jamal Murray. He's been sensational. And I just, like, this is awesome to see.
Let me tie off this part of the conversation with a quote from Eric Spoelstra, Miami Heat coach, who was asked about Tyler Hero's development. I think it applies to Jamal Murray as well. Spoelstra said last night, everybody overestimates what you can do in a day, and they underestimate what you can do in months of work, sweat, and grind when nobody is watching. So what he's saying is there's not one particular breakout moment from Tyler Hero's rookie season where the light bulb switched on. All of a sudden, Hero's now a player. I think you can say the same thing with Murray. I mean, for him, there's all these legendary stories about how hard his dad was on him in terms of not letting him have cell phones and forcing him to be, in the gym and doing all these mental and breathing exercises.
Meditation.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, just basically structuring his whole life around the sport. That work has paid off here, and it hasn't stopped. This guy's out on the court early before every game, going through this crazy dribbling routine with two basketballs through his legs, behind his back, getting himself in the right rhythm. He shoots from all over the court. He practices every shot he takes in these games, including the crazy step back threes that you're describing. This is a lifelong commitment to the sport from Jamal Murray that has gotten him to this point. You can say the same about Steph. You can say the same about a lot of NBA players, but it's paying off right now, and you just love to see that. When a guy is that dedicated to his craft and he's getting the results, it doesn't make me cry, but it does bring just a slight little tear to my eye every once in a while, Michael. Maybe I missed up a little bit watching somebody completely fulfill their potential. It's beautiful. All right, let's close up here with a couple quick questions. I just need a thumbs up or thumbs down or a thumbs sideways on Billy Donovan to the Chicago Bulls. And can you explain to me just the fundamental question here? He leaves Oklahoma City after 5 years because there's talk that the Thunder are going to go through a rebuild, and yet he goes to a Bulls job, which is obviously a rebuild. I mean, they're just building around, you know, three or four recent lottery picks and Zach LaVine. Why would you do that if you're Billy Donovan? But does it make sense for Chicago?
Definitely makes sense for Chicago. I like this hire a lot in terms of, like, the credibility that he brings to the table that their last head coach could not.
Thinking if I worked for The Onion, my headline would have been Bulls hire not Jim Boylan, right? Or like smash hit Bulls hire not Jim Boylan, and like just have that be the story. Is that why it was a good hire, or is it something specific about Billy for you?
Well, I think that first of all, if you're Billy, like, we don't know exactly the money issues yet. I don't know what has been I haven't seen anything reported about the exact financial figures that he's getting from Chicago versus what was offered in Oklahoma City, and that might be a factor here. But, like, number one, Chicago. You get to live in Chicago and coach the Bulls. That's just, like, not the same thing as living in Oklahoma City and coaching the Thunder. I know that, like, I'm going to say no disrespect, but I also do mean disrespect because, like, it's just no question. And so the Bulls are, in my opinion, closer to the title than the Oklahoma City Thunder, presuming that the Oklahoma City Thunder trade Chris Paul, which is very likely, and they don't make that James Harden, Joel Embiid blockbuster trade that I suggested on here a couple weeks ago. But I think going back to just credibility, having Billy Donovan as your head coach is so much different when you go to free agency. I expect this team, which has a lot of cap space in the summer of 2021, I expect them to make a huge jump in terms of just regular season record next season. They had a lot of injuries. All their guys will be older, and there will be much more stability in how they play the game because Billy Donovan is just a good basketball coach who relates to players really well, and players respect him. So I think this is a really good hire for the Chicago Bulls. And even though we look at them and we say that they're rebuilding, like, I'm not going to say that, you know, they're guaranteed to sign someone like Brad Beal in a couple off seasons, but, like, them going from where they are now to winning a playoff series, I don't think is as far as it might seem.
look, they needed to establish competence, you know, just bottom line. And I think that Billy Donovan, if nothing else, does that. I think that, you know, is he going to be a free agent draw and all that? I don't know, but he's definitely going to be better than Boylan on that kind of a front. you know, it's pretty simple there. I also think for him, you can make the case that he's just a couple years ahead in the rebuilding cycle. Like if Oklahoma City does trade Chris Paul and they're starting fresh and now it's Shea's team and you're just seeing where that goes in the Western Conference, there's going to be a lot of lumps there. And I also think when you decide in that final year of a five-year contract to basically just kind of play it out to the end, like they do really have to bring the bag after leaving you as kind of a, you know, a lame duck coach in that final year, especially if you're like a top three coach of the year finisher. Like you expect to really be rewarded for that. And I could understand from Oklahoma City's perspective where you're like, you are heading into a rebuilding situation. Like you don't want to pay top dollar for a coach necessarily. That's not your top priority, especially if you're a small market. So it did seem like they just kind of parted fairly amicably at the right time. And there is some level of appeal to this Bulls job. I think the biggest part of the appeal is just expectations are so low. They can't be cratered anymore. And so for a coach, that's always good. You get to come in, turn things around just a little bit. Everybody calls you a genius. And that's not too bad at all. All right, Michael, we've reached just about the end of another episode of Open Floor, but we got one late-breaking question in. It's from Victor in Sweden. He says, I've been a big fan of the podcast for about a year now, and I get way too amped up for each episode. Too kind, Victor, too kind. He says, a few months ago, a fellow Open Floor Glow member sent an email requesting a segment at the end of each episode where the pod gives everybody some reading tips. He talks about articles or books or anything related to literature and writing. I realize that a large part of your guys' demographic may not be that interested in such a segment, but I'm a literature nerd, and so I want you and the pod to make it a thing. And he says, P.S. Celtics in 7. So, Michael, is this one of your directly family members living in Sweden, or is this actually Victor, as he claims?
This is me ghostwriting email to Open Floor.
It's actually a great strategy for you. I mean, it would have been better if I didn't already get in 45 minutes of Celtics digs, you know, but it was a good deflection strategy. Can I just kick this off? I mean, it's a quick plug. Jeff Perlman sent me here in the bubble his new book that's called Three Ring Circus, which is an incredible title for a book all about the Lakers of the early 2000s, Kobe, Shaq era. You know, he's got all sorts of interviews with Jeannie Buss and everybody else on down there in the Lakers that are going to be informing that book. I'm very excited to start reading it. He's in full promotion mode all across the world right now. He's on TV and podcasts and everything else. So I'm sure you've heard of this book. I'm probably not the first person to mention it. But just in case, Victor, in Sweden, if you're interested in a kind of a deep dive to one of the more dramatic, melodramatic, tense, but also, successful eras and runs of the last, 25 years or so in the NBA, that would be a good place to start. And I believe it's out right now kind of everywhere. Michael, I know you've always got esoteric options for our listeners. What have you been reading? What's been top of mind for you? And how are you going to satisfy Victor, who wants the pod's book club?
Yeah, so first of all, I really want to read Jeff Perlman's book as well. He's one of my favorite authors, and Showtime was a tremendous book that he previously wrote about the 80s Lakers and Magic Johnson and that rise. So I also can't wait to dig into that one. So I'm not really reading anything about basketball right now. I'm trying to kind of get my mind, like before I go to bed, just in a different world. So I've been reading novels, and the one I just finished is called Homegoing by, I'm going to mispronounce the author's name, so bear with me, but I believe her name is Ya Gyasi, and she's from Ghana and grew up in Alabama. And so that book, Homegoing, is basically about two sisters from centuries ago, and one of them is involved in the mid-Atlantic slave trade and comes to the United States, and the other one stays in West Africa. And each chapter is a push forward through time to kind of see the effects of the family, and right up until I guess not present day, but pretty close to present day, and just how that move and that what that event was, and you know, the 1700s or whatever it was, how that affected this family from two different perspectives. Really good book, really enjoyed it, and now because I loved it so much, I bought her new novel called Transcended Kingdom, and I'm like 20 pages into it, so I can't really speak too much about it. But she's just an incredible writer, and so that's kind of what I've been digging into. So I just answered my own email, and
there,
I'm proud of it.
There you go, Victor. The pod never disappoints. He's always got something to make you think. Check it out. Is it available online, widely available for our international listeners, Michael? Or are you going to have to do an audiobook version maybe where you maybe you could actually like read the book on Instagram Live and Victor could watch you read it? What do you think?
That would be a little creepy. I believe Victor can buy his own copy. It's Homegoing won awards, so that one should definitely be out there. And this one was a highly anticipated drop that just came out. So I would imagine that he shouldn't have too much difficulty finding his own copy.
Well, there you go, Victor. Here we go. Just trying to satisfy all the happy customers out there around the world, Michael. Great job. All right. We've reached the end of another episode of Open Floor. As I mentioned earlier, follow Michael on Instagram and Twitter at Michael V as in Victor Pina. I'm on Instagram at Ben.Golliver, on Twitter at Ben Golliver. Lots of stories up on the Washington Post this week. Check them out, washingtonpost.com/sports. We are on Apple Podcasts. If you search for Open Floor, that's two words. When you find our page, you can scroll down. It will say rate and review. Tap 5 stars. It's just that easy to help us spread the word. Michael, next week, we're going to be coming back with some hot 2020 NBA Finals talk. I cannot wait. The finish line is coming into focus. Until then, Michael, I will talk to you.
Talk soon, Ben.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.